Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, news and views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. So, hey, Sarah.
Hey, Stacey, how's it going?
It's going really good. I'm excited about our show tonight.
I am too. I'm like super excited.
I'm also super excited that we've tested Skype like 18,000 times and supposedly it's recording.
Oh, my fingers are crossed. I really, really don't want to have issues with this one.
Yeah, I'm almost tempted to like put in some fail safes and whatever, but we're going to trust technology. So anyway, I'm also really excited because this week you secured pretty good news that you should share with everyone about...
I have decided to leave my family for the first time ever and come to Virginia to come to the Beyond Bacon release party on July 5th.
Yay. I'm so honored that we are the reason for you to abandon your family.
Ever since you announced it, I've been like, oh, that would be so fun to go to. Oh, that would be so fun to go to. And then someone I know very, very well named Stacey Toth said something very, very profound, which was, why don't you? And then I went, yeah, why don't I? So, you know, I priced out tickets and they were a fortune. And then my husband said, well, let's look if we can redeem some Delta Sky Miles. And we could. So $5 later, I have a flight.
Nice.
I know. I don't know if it would have happened if that hadn't, if those flights hadn't been available. And so, yeah, I'm super excited. I'm like a little bit nervous to leave my kids because I've like, other than spending the night in the hospital with one of them, I've never left them. yeah, and we're actually going to get to meet.
It will be crazy. It will be a very full house full of lots of paleo loving, good food, and I'm sure we'll do something. We'll definitely be on social media sharing all about it. So make sure to check it out.
Phone will be fully charged for that trip.
And next week, Beyond Bacon comes out. So, but before we talk about anything else, really, I just want to touch base with you before we bring on our super special guest. So why don't we go ahead and...
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I'm so excited. I'm like as nervous as I was when Mark Sisson joined the show because we've got like a superstar. So I'm going to try and do some breathing. I got to yoga today. So yeah, let's get him on. Let's get Joel on.
Okay.
Hello, this is Joel.
Hi, Joel. This is Stacey Toth and Sarah Ballantyne.
Yeah, this is Sarah. Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Yes, indeed.
It's good weather in Virginia. It's still light outside, so I don't know if you would normally be outside at this time. But
No, I'm just doing desk work. I've got usually a couple of hours of evening desk work and emails and anyway, things to deal with.
Yes.
So I used to be out after supper till dark, but now I'm a little more administrative, too much administrative work.
Well, it's got to get done. Sarah and I know all about that.
Yeah. So. I spend far more time than I would like to at a desk.
So, welcome to the Paleo View. I actually watched your Pigs and Glenn show yesterday, and I think perfect mesh with what we're going to talk about today.
Good.
So I know it's one of your newer projects, just for people who are kind of living who knows where and don't know who you are.
Sure.
You are the proprietor of Polyface Farm, it's a family-owned farm. And you've been featured in documentaries. I know we first saw you in Food Inc. And you're the author of several of your own books, including Folks This Ain't Normal, Pastured Poultry Profits, The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer, which, you know, who doesn't love a lunatic farmer? Family-friendly farming, Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal, which I think was your most recent, but I might be wrong on that.
The most recent was Folks This Ain't Normal.
Okay.
Yeah, Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal was about 3 ago.
Okay.
Because Ecstasy came after that one, too. So it was one before Ecstasy, so it was three ago.
Wow, you're shooting them out faster than
Got another one coming out this year, too.
And then recently you're also doing a series of videos, which is specifically what I was talking about, and you're calling them the Polyface Primer series or Primer series. And the one that I viewed was called Pigs and Glenn, which was really fascinating. We actually watched it after we watched True Blood last night, and Matt said that he was more fascinated by your DVD than True Blood.
Oh my. Well, that's saying something.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, we have a particular interest in knowledge and in raising swine in general, not that we intend to do it ourselves. We live very much in suburbia, but it was very interesting for us. A lot of things we did know, a lot of stuff we didn't know, or we found more information about. And I think it's really cool what you're doing to share a great mechanism to share a lot of the knowledge that you have in an easy, straightforward way. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, we're pretty excited about it. A picture's worth 1,000 words. So when we have this medium now, and I still like books. I'm still old school, but I definitely appreciate, you know, what video can bring to a topic. So that's good. And we're trying to do it in a professional way, so the videos are not just, you know, informational, but they're also entertaining and fun to watch.
Yeah, they were, absolutely. Are you planning on doing those streaming online at all, or will they be only? Okay, great.
Yes, in fact, we are having a big meeting Wednesday evening, all of us, to I think iron out the final details of the streaming, and should be able to offer that within a week or two.
Well, I think that'll be awesome. So this show will go live kind of a few days from now. So for those of you checking it out, I would suggest looking into it. It sounds like streaming is in the very imminent future from when you'll actually be listening to this podcast. So make sure that you go check it out. Is there anything I missed, Joel? I mean, obviously, also, I should mention that you wrote the foreword to our upcoming book, Beyond Bacon, which we're completely honored and grateful that you did. You're one of the reasons that we were inspired to start eating sustainably, humanely raised meats, and really wanted to share that message in recipe form, which is kind of venue.
It's a wonderful book. It's the kind of thing that now, you know, so many people, they have this deer in the headlights look. I mean, I finished talking to a group, and they just in their heart, they know I'm right. They know they need to get involved in their kitchen. They know they need to participate in their ecology, and they need to get connected to their ecological umbilical. I mean, there's a million ways to say this, but it's just overwhelming to a lot of people. They're paralyzed with too many ways to start. And so what happens is, you know, too often they don't start. And Beyond Bacon, to me, is just one of those parts of the, I call it the empowerment, you know, the empowerment grid that allows a person to get over that initial paralysis, you know, and it's real. I mean, we have to appreciate those of us who just grew up gardening and canning and, you know, scratch cooking. It's hard to appreciate the fear and the paralysis that that engulfs people when they first realize, oh, I need to get an uncooked something, you know.
Yeah.
Well, cook it.
And even for you know, people who, I mean, I did grow up canning and not hunting, but fishing a lot of my own food because I grew up near the ocean and we gardened. And I still, when I started eating sort of snout to tail, there's a lot of things that were new for me and very intimidating. I think that's what Beyond Bacon is going to bring for everyone, just to speak for you, Stacey, is going to bring cooking that way and that very economical and environmentally friendly and also really healthy way approachable and not so intimidating for people, so that, you know, they can look at it and go, okay, well, that's what I do with feet. Okay, I've got it.
Right.
Well, thank you both.
I agree. I think it's wonderful. I mean, there are some, you know, some other, I mean, you know, what Shannon Hayes has done with the, you know, grass-fed beef, the herbivore stuff, pastured herbivore, is fabulous. So yeah, we're seeing these enabling pieces coming forth now, and it's fabulous.
Yeah, well, I think specific to our movement, not to kind of belabor the fact, but there is a lot of understanding and focus, like you said, of these things are valuable and people understand and they want to do it, but then faced with the idea of, okay, what do I buy and how do I cook it, overwhelms a lot of people. And so it's not just our book, but I think in general, the whole real food movement needs to veer more towards, let's not just talk about organ meat being nutrient dense and healthy for you and good for the environment. Let's start actually eating it and stop making it be this taboo, ooh, gross thing. You know, it's
right.
Mm-hmm. It isn't. So.
Yeah, that's great.
Cool. Well, so the way that our show usually works is we do this little chit-chatty thing. And then Sarah, who is actually a PhD, does a little thing called Science with Sarah. And I think she's got something planned that you could contribute to, kind of talking about animals and that kind of stuff. Sarah, are you ready to jump into that?
Yeah, yes. I'm always ready. What are you talking about?
Cool.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys. So today for Science with Sarah, because we have Joel on talking about the living conditions of pasture-raised and grass-fed animals and all of the sort of issues around raising those animals, I thought it would be a really good opportunity to talk about the difference in nutritional content between pasture-raised meat and meat that is quote-unquote raised conventionally, which is a term that I really dislike because there's really nothing conventional about concentrated animal feeding organizations. But there really is some dramatic differences in the nutritional quality. And in the paleo community, we're probably all familiar with the difference in the omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acid ratio and the fact that pasture-raised meat tends to have a much lower fat content than conventionally raised or grain-fed meat does. And in fact, the difference in omega-3s, it's really that the omega-3 content in pasture-raised meat is higher and the omega-6 content is lower. So the ratio between them is quite different. It definitely varies, and it varies by season, by animal, by cut of meat, by the quality of the food that they are getting, and it varies by whether or not they're supplemented. It varies even by breed within the type of animal. But in general, you can expect something like a 3-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 in grass-fed meat. In grain-fed meat, it is anywhere between 4 to 1. In some cuts of meat, it actually is that good, to 20 to 1. And we really know that for optimal human health, we should be aiming for a intake ratio anywhere from 1 to 1 to 3 to 1, 4 to 1, somewhere in that range. The fats, it's not just about omega-3s to omega-6. There are actually some other really important healthy fats in pasture-raised and grass-fed animals. People have probably heard about conjugated linoleic acid. It's called, or CLA. This is an incredibly important fat for overall health and for heart health. And it is pasture-raised meat and dairy from animals raised on pasture is the most concentrated food source of conjugated linoleic acid available by a large margin. There's another fat that's really important, and it's called oleic acid. Oleic acid, I've mentioned it before in podcasts. It's a omega-9 monounsaturated fat, and it is the fat in olive oil, macadamia nut oil, walnut oil that seems to be responsible for a lot of the heart benefits of those fats. And it is actually really high in pasture-raised meat and the fat from pasture-raised meat. And the difference, of course, as I mentioned, it's variable. But even animals that are organically grown and get even a third of their diet from being on pasture will have an improved fat profile. So it'll have better levels of these really healthy fats. So that's sort of a familiar concept, I think, for many of our listeners, that the fats are better. But there's actually a lot of other nutrients that are higher in grass-fed animals compared to grain-fed that I think we sometimes glaze over when we're talking about the difference between, pasture-raised animals and conventionally raised animals. So there's a number of vitamins and minerals that are higher. And again, really varies. So when you look at papers that measure these, you know, one might show 20% improvement and another paper might show a tenfold improvement. So there is going to be some variability, and there really haven't been like broad scope studies to really nail down and compare the nutritional differences, I think because there isn't really money in and research to support that kind of research right now. But grass-fed beef can contain up to 10 times as much beta-carotene than grain-fed. Beta-carotene is a precursor for vitamin A. The body converts it into vitamin A. And up to 4 times as much vitamin E. And what's really important about those vitamins is that they're really, really strong antioxidants. And actually, because of their antioxidant activity, meat from grass-fed and pasture-raised animals is less subject to oxidation, which means it doesn't go brown with storage. And it's actually because of the excess content of beta-carotene and vitamin E. I mean, so much so that there have been studies investigating enriching the diets in CAFO organizations to mimic that property of grass-fed and pasture-raised meat in conventionally raised meat so that that meat can store better and ship better without losing its flavor and getting all brown and not as good. There's some other vitamins that are higher in grass-fed meat, B vitamins, all of them, zinc, iron, phosphorus, and potassium. And zinc is a really important mineral and one that most people are deficient in, and one that, you know, everyone knows that I care a lot about autoimmune disease, one that has the strongest link with immune and autoimmune diseases in terms of the deficiency being potentially contributing factor to the development of those diseases. And then another really important thing to keep in mind is because pasture-raised animals are outside, their fat actually contains vitamin D. And vitamin D is practically non-existent in animals that grow up in these factories where they don't see the sunlight at all. So I've seen citations that show that pastured lard is actually one of the top three food sources of vitamin D. And it's because those animals make it. And when they make this fat-soluble vitamin, it gets stored in their fat as they're growing. So the nutritional content is actually really remarkably higher. These animals also tend to be higher in protein. They have, their meat has lower water content. It does have lower fat content overall. It also is safer meat. So studies show that the risk of E. coli contamination in grass-fed meat is vastly, vastly, vastly lower than conventional meat. And because these animals are not fed antibiotics or hormones, you don't get that environmental source of estrogen mimicking compounds that, well, no, they're estrogens, but you don't get that environmental estrogen component. I mean, it's the reason why we avoid so many other things like soy and BPA. So you get that benefit. And then without the antioxidants, one of the other great things that you get is a vastly reduced risk of developing antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And that's one of the big challenges now in concentrated feedlots, is that they're being given more and more antibiotics because of these antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So hands down, it's really no contest. But these are the reasons why, sort of on a much broader scope than just omega-3s and omega-6s, why pasture-raised and grass-fed animals are so much better for us to eat. I mean, in addition, you get the environmental impact. There's less fuel costs getting food to them, even if they're supplemented with feed. They're not reliant on feed being shipped in from large monocrop factory farms. And then you're not supporting those large factory farms that are degrading the topsoil and leaching fertilizers and pesticides into the rivers and lakes and oceans. And you're often, when you buy this kind of meat, the vast majority of the time, you're supporting local farms, family-owned farms, and it's a completely different economy. And so those are, like the fringe benefits, I guess. And if you want to just look at it from a nutritional perspective, there's really no contest.
Joel, I think one of the things that is really interesting as I've learned and read more about some of the stuff that you're doing is you also focus on how it's actually financially beneficial from a business perspective for farmers to take on the model that, or a similar model to the one that you use, utilizing every part of the land that you have in a rotation in which it allows all of the different animals to kind of do the work for you often. And I think that's kind of to add on to what Sarah's saying in terms of local economy and good for the earth. If you can find a farm that has, good practices, I don't know how else to describe it, but you get all these nutritional benefits, but all the stuff Joel focuses on too.
Yeah. Well, one of the beauties of the pasture-based livestock model is that the infrastructure is portable, and which means that it is extremely low cost, it is flexible, and you don't have high energy, things like fans and concrete and heating and cooling and all that. You don't have that kind of high energy to run the facility. So, what you have is just simple portable infrastructure, nursery, shade cloth, whatever, on a big trailer, and that's your shelter. You haven't poured concrete. You don't even have to haul manure anywhere. You don't have to haul bedding in. There's just a tremendous difference in just carbon footprint, energy, energy use per pound of meat. Now people will argue, but yours is more labor intensive. Well, what we're doing is we're substituting labor for infrastructure and energy. And I don't apologize for substituting labor. I mean, don't we need people employed?
True. But,
well, what's wrong with employing people as opposed to, you know, having to use a lot of extra energy, which has its own, you know, cost, which is another topic for another day, cost besides dollar, besides dollars. I mean, it has environmental costs, has all sorts of things. And so the less energy dependent we are, obviously, you know, and energy policy for the country would be better if the policy used less energy. You know, it just, it wouldn't be such a big issue. So, the pasture-based idea model has some really cool ramifications for the entire food system. You know, they're embedded in the landscape. I mean, you know, the great big confinement animal feeding operation doesn't dominate the landscape either aesthetically or aromatically. As we say, a farm should be aromatically and aesthetically sensually romantic.
It's true though, because I visited your farm among several other. You know, we in this area are really privileged to have a lot of awesome farms, and so I've also gone to Sally Fallon's farm, and we frequently buy from Mount Vernon Farm, who happens to have local delivery for us.
Right.
And all three of those farms that we've been to have no crazy, disgusting aroma the way that, like, oftentimes when you mulch your yard, it smells worse than your farms do, you know?
Right.
And it's because it's naturally aerated, and that they have land, and they get to move around and do what they need to do. But, you know, I actually went to Nevada a few years ago, well, more than a decade ago, and we were driving through, and I remember we had to roll up our windows for hours because we just went through some sort of stretch of the highway where there were a bunch of CAFO farms, and even though we couldn't see them, we could smell them miles and miles away. And we finally got close enough when we were like, oh my gosh, that's what that smell is. Like, that's a CAFO farm. That's what made us smell 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing is, a lot of the workers on those kind of places wear respirators to clean the air before they breathe it. Well, the animals, they don't have respirators on the animals. The animals live right in the thick of it, their whole 24/7, and without any respiratory, filtering. So yeah, it's a pretty despicable situation.
And, you know, not surprising, they all need antibiotics because they're all sick from stewing and poo and being surrounded by all of that contamination. Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things is I heard about these things and I knew about these things, but I always thought, well, the pork chop I buy at the giant grocery store isn't that pork chop. You know, it's like my pork chop is a special pig that didn't, you know, I had like a mental block, and I was like, Costco pork chop is fine. It's the other pork chops that are the problem.
Yeah, right. You know, yesterday I just got the official magazine. I'm on their mailing list for some reason. The official pork checkoff report. It's the industry, the pork industry magazine, the official.
They don't know to leave you off of that.
And so I'm looking here. They've spent 3 years. Now codifying their new revised Pork Quality Assurance Plus program, PQA Plus, copyright, you know, pork checkoff. And so they've got 10 rules for what makes, you know, pork quality assurance. And the first one is to use appropriate veterinarian-client-patient relationship as the basis for medication decision-making. Number two is to establish and implement an efficient and effective health management plan, which is essentially about medications. Number three is use antibiotics responsibly. Number four, properly store and administer antibiotic products.
Wow.
You know, you just read down through, and virtually all of them are regarding antibiotic use. And, you know, and the industry says, well, You know, we don't use them unless it's necessary. Well, they don't. It's just that it's always necessary. And so there's a tremendous amount of clever speak and wordsmithing in these things. I just got a come on today to sign on to this, you know, Senate bill to to make sure that, that veterinarians can, you know, carry antibiotics with them. And I mean, and basically I'm okay with that. But what's fascinating to me is that the whole argument being put forth to make sure that the vets can use pretty much indiscriminate use of antibiotics is for animal health and public safety and welfare. You know, and that if we don't continue pretty much a carte blanche cheerleader mentality toward the use of drugs, we're going to endanger the country's food supply, food security. We're going to endanger public health, and we're going to endanger public safety. It's just it's pretty amazing. And most people, because they don't live in the world that I live in, don't see this stuff. You know, they think the government's taking care of all this stuff. Oh, you know, if we just have, well, now that Obama's in there, you know, everything's going to be fine. It's all going to be fixed. And of course, you know, one of the first things he did was put Michael Taylor, the Monsanto attorney who brought genetically modified organisms to the world, in as his arbiter of the Food Modernization Act, which means that this guy is going to tell us, you know, what food is proper or not. And he's a 10-year Monsanto dude. So don't think the government's watching your back.
Yeah, we all have to watch our own backs. And,
that's right.
You know, for me, that was kind of self-education, and it was a rude awakening to realize that the Costco pork chop was the pork chop that was the problem, and that, you know, there was no my pork chop is an exception, I guess. Do you find that, because we've talked a lot about pork, that, you know, some animals are easier to raise than others in the ways that you raise them, i.e. are some animals more likely to get sick where, you know, you have a difficult time if you don't have kind of perfect conditions for them? I've seen your chicken coop house, and, well, at least where the baby chicks were when I came. It was a huge facility compared to a lot of the photos that I see of other people kind of putting their chicks in places. And I'm wondering, you know, is that a conscious decision that you've made based on, you know, your experience or things with other animals other than pork in those kind of living conditions?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, I'll be straight transparent with you. In my perfect world, we really wouldn't raise very many chickens. Chickens would be dispersed. If there's one animal that can be raised in a house, it's a chicken. You know, there was not a chicken industry. Chickens were raised. If every kitchen had enough chickens attached to it to eat the scraps, there would not be a chicken industry in this country. I mean, a chicken industry as we know it, the CAFOs and big chicken farms and things like that. And the beauty of chickens, of course, is that they're as easy to keep as a gerbil. They don't take any more room than a hamster, and it takes 11 chickens to eat as much feed as one dog.
Wow.
So, yeah, so people that say, oh, you know, chickens are be dirty and what are they going to eat and all this stuff. Well, they eat your kitchen scraps, and how many people, I mean, you know how big the pet cat and pet dog food and veterinary care market is? And the U.S. spends more money on just veterinary care for pet dogs and cats than the entire continent of Africa spends on all human medical care in the entire continent of Africa.
Okay, that's just, wow.
I mean, you know, when people say, oh, you know, we can't feed the world, my goodness, we just got a call last week, you're going to love this, from an outfit that asked if we could use $2 million of dog food a month. Now, right now, they're sending most of it to, you know, to industrial, to CAFOs. And, you know, the thing is, this is food that either got messed up somehow, whether it was past a use-by date or improperly mixed or whatever. Of course, it's in little, you know, little four-ounce tins, right? Wet dog food. But 2 million pounds a month, I mean, that's like 40, 50, you know, tractor trailer loads. And that's just one company making one dog food product.
And that's their waste.
That's their waste. Yeah, that's not what they're selling. That's their waste, and they're trying to get rid of it. Of course, we told them no. But anyway, you know, it's hard to conceive of the amount of food product, edible product, that you know, that is not eaten by humans. You know, at no time in world history has more human food been either thrown away, spoiled, or landfilled, or not used. You know, and here we, you know, here we have stainless steel, refrigeration, freezing. We got all sorts of cool technology, and we're, you know, and it's going other places besides people. And then people are scared there's not enough food to eat. The fact is, there's plenty of food to eat.
Meanwhile, all the people in the rest of the world are starving.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's the great anomaly of our day that we have almost to the person exactly the same number of overweight people as underweight people. You know, that's the great anomaly of our time, that we have just as many people overweight as we have undernourished. And of course, you know, people that are overweight are undernourished. But you know, it's a.
Yeah, we seem to produce a lot of calories, but not a lot of nutrition.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and one of the things, and talk about a nuance of meat. This was done with our pork by a couple of chefs. Fascinating thing where they did a displacement test. I was interested in all your, you know, your all the nutrition stuff. It's very real. But here's one that's fascinating. They took a beaker of water, and they put in, you know, 1 pound of whatever, Smithfield pork, and they put in a pound of ours, and ours displaces less water. What that means is that ours is much more dense per pound, that it weighs more per cubic inch than the Smithfield pork. And, you know, we have the saying, everybody intuitively understands, you are what you eat. And so when we talk about muscle and you talk about you are what you eat, what you want is density. You want density. You don't want flab. You don't want, and that's exactly what the industry does, in that they confine the animals so they don't get any exercise, they don't get fresh air, they don't get sunshine, any of those things that that create firmness. And so what happens is that you eat that, and then you indicate that yourself. So what we want is firm muscle. My father-in-law used to raise hogs, and he sold a lot of them to restaurants down in Stanton, and the way they made their piggery. Now the pigs, you know, could run out in a yard there. It wasn't a pastured situation, more a kind of a weed lot. But anyway, they did run out there, and they didn't make the access easy to get back up where the feeder and where they slopped them, put the slop in the troughs. The pigs had to jump up about 2.5 feet. Up into the piggery to get to where the slop was, and the reason was because they wanted them to have to jump up in there to exercise their muscles, and that made a much, much better ham because it was getting exercise.
Cool.
And so, you know, this was something that people just intuitively understood. You want, you know, you want firmness, you want texture, you want structure. They didn't know all about, you know, vitamin E and D and all that stuff. But what, but what they knew was that you want structure, and you don't get structure by, you know, confining in a little itty bitty cubicle on slats and denying exercise, fresh air, and sunshine, and all the things that help us to get some exercise.
I think this is, if I can, just the kind of crux of the misconception that came about, you know, at the kind of the beginning of the paleo movement. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but for those people who are confused, we get a lot of questions about, I don't understand why you're suggesting eating so much saturated fat. It's a misconception. Pigs aren't actually as saturated as people think they are, but so much saturated fat, or why you're encouraging such a high fat diet, because paleo is supposed to be lean meats. And I think, you know, what you just described is exactly the crux of where that argument originally came from in a book called The Paleo Diet, the original version by Dr. Lauren Cordain. I interpreted that work to be exactly how you described it, as he said the original animals roamed the land, they were muscular, and they had naturally leaner meat than those that you can find in a CAFO, who are just laying around and literally getting fat. And it wasn't necessarily to say you should only eat chicken breast. It was to say you should be eating animals who are naturally leaner than their kind of counterpart, who's just chubbing away on dog food and cornmeal and accumulating fat. Because
I can assure you, it is logistically impossible to put the amount of fat on an herbivore, a beef, lamb, or goat, with pasture that you can put on it with grain. You simply cannot put that on there. You know, I mean, it's to put it in perspective, when you see the animals coming out of the feedlot, they are equivalent in the animal kingdom to the kind of people that are on the reality TV shows that are morbidly obese. That's the equivalent.
Absolutely. I mean, and oftentimes they can't even stand.
Yeah. And so to suggest that there's anything nutritional or, you know, good about that kind of a morbidly obese critter, or there's anything natural about it, is just, it's just crazy. So for example, so what's happened is that the industries, especially the pork and the beef industry, have genetically selected for phenotypes, phenotypes that are great, 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 great big, and very difficult to put fat on. So they're trying to fight the accumulation of fat by making ever bigger carcasses that are extremely inefficient, in order to ameliorate this high calorie diet that's going to finish them off. And whereas those of us that are doing, you know, grass finished, why, a lot of our cows don't even weigh 1,000 pounds. Goodness, you know, most of the cows that our neighbors have weigh 1,400 or 1,500 pounds. They're just big, massive cows, and
the difference is 400 or 500 pounds of fat.
Well, no. It's a phenotype. It's a lot of its bone and cartilage. It's just a great big. It's just a great, great big animal
to carry all of that extra,
you know,
stuff around.
What they're selecting for are, you know, equivalent to people who are 7 feet 8 inches tall and weigh, you know, they're trying to create a whole herd of Shaquille O'Neals.
Wow.
and that's Think of what a different world we would have if everybody was Shaquille O'Neal. I mean, think about car design and house design and bathtub design. Bed design. Wouldn't you hate to be that huge?
I mean, it's impossible.
I'm not dissing Shaquille O'Neal. I mean, he's an anomaly. I mean, and a wonderful guy, but he's an anomaly. And so when you start thinking about, you know, what if that became our goal, our standard, you know, it just changes a lot of things. And that's what's happened in the beef industry. So your original question was, are there some things that are easier? And I started, got off tangent with chickens. But the easiest thing to do, you know, 100% true blue through and through is the herbivore. And you guys haven't mentioned genetically modified organisms, but for the listeners that are, you know, wanting to stay away from GMOs, the beauty is that grass-finished herbivore, you know, whether it's a guinea pig or a cow or a lamb or a goat or an alpaca or a giraffe or an elephant, or, you know, there's a lot of herbivores. A yak, reindeer, elk, deer. All right, you with me?
Yes. I don't know that I'm with you. I thought a goat was an omnivore. Now I feel like I'm...
Oh, no. A goat is an herbivore. Absolutely. Goat's an herbivore. It's a ruminant.
Learn something new every day?
Yeah, ruminant animal. Anyway, the herbivore, by definition, does not need any grain, which is where all the GMOs have gone into. Now, I know that Obama has okayed the first forage plant, alfalfa, as a GMO. And of course, you know, at our farm, we don't have any alfalfa either. But for sure, the herbivore is the animal that is the easiest to raise ancestrally. You know, if you want to say, what's the most paleo-ish of the paleo opportunities, it's the herbivore because it doesn't require grain. The porks, the omnivore, the chicken and the pig are a little more difficult.
So what?
Well, I think. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, because Stacy's book is about pork and they are omnivores. Like when we buy pork, they're always supplemented with something.
Yes.
What are they typically fed? Like what do you feed your pigs and your chickens?
Yeah.
Like,
well, our supplement is GMO free. We don't use any genetically modified organisms, but we do feed them, grain and virtually everybody does that unless you happen to be located next to, for example, a cheese making facility where you can feed whey the pig dairy relationship is extremely old. Not only the pig mast relationship, mast with being tree fruit, tree nuts and things, but the pig dairy, because the pigs could eat boiled milk in a day before refrigeration. You know, a lot of milk didn't get drunk in time, and so the pigs actually. It was in a day of expensive grain, it was much, listen to this, this will blow your mind, it was much more cost effective to have an herbivore harvesting a perennial that never had to be planted, i.e. a Jersey or Guernsey or Holstein cow eating grass, milk that cow for a high protein food source and feed that to the pig. That was actually more economical and ecological than feeding the pig corn and soybeans and all that stuff.
Well, it probably still is more economical. It's just that we are paying for that grain in different ways.
Well, okay. My cousin's got a hobby farm just over a year ago, and that was like my first, I had never heard of that before, but the first thing they got was a dairy cow, and then they needed something to do with all of the extra milk that they couldn't consume. And so they got pigs, and that was like the whole, like the plan, like let's get the cow, but then we need to get the pigs so that we have some animals to eat all this extra milk.
Yeah. Right. I think Sally Fallon is doing that as well. And she's also, because she's Sally and full of awesome, she's soaking and sprouting her grains before she gives it to her animals as well, which is just amazing. But yeah, I think it's really important what you've said, because we get a lot of questions from people. And in particular, they've actually said to me, well, you know, Joel feeds his pigs supplemental feed. And I'm like, yes, that's what pigs eat. They're omnivores. They can't just eat twigs on the ground. I mean, yes, if you have leftover fruit and scraps, and, you know, if you have a vegetable farm nearby and they give you their leftover, you know, going bad veggies or whatever, the pigs are happy to have that. But for the most part, like, especially when you're talking about raising more than just a backyard pig, they need that varied diet that specifically GMO-free pig feed that you're getting, that has a balance of what their diet is created to eat. You're not just giving them leftover dog food off of a truck that's coming in, you know?
Yeah, that's right. And one of the important things to remember is that pigs were generally raised in edges. They were raised on wastelands. George Washington raised them out in the woods. So did Thomas Jefferson. They ate acorns. And of course, at that time, the eastern U.S. was full of chestnuts. And, pigs would fatten on the chestnuts in the fall. But the reason that the foundation of all historical ancestral diets was the herbivore is because that was the nutrient-dense substance. I'm being very generic here. That was the nutrient-dense food that could be raised without tillage, because tillage was extremely laborious until, modern energy and machinery. And so so pigs and chickens were relegated to the homestead. They kind of ate the scraps and, junk around the house, cast-offs and waste products. And pigs typically were either hooked up with extra milk, or primarily were in the edges. They were in the waste edges, in the field edges, in the forest edges, and were kind of a scavenger edge type of animal. And so the mainstay was the herbivore. That's why I tell people without any question, if you want to really eat traditional, forget the chicken. The chicken is the least one, and go for the herbivore primarily, and with a little bit of pork. That is the order, and that's why all traditional ancestral diets were herbivore based, whether it was buffalo or or cow or deer or whatever. It was either that or fish based. And again, why fish? Because again, fish was a nutrient dense food source that didn't require cultivation, didn't require tillage to grow grain. Pretty much all the grain went into bread making, bread baking, because it was too expensive to till for grain otherwise.
And you mean that that feed that they're giving the koi fish at the zoo is not their natural diet? Are you sure?
Yeah, just a I'm joke. Sure.
All those unhealthy fat koi fish, my kids were like, I don't think they're supposed to be eating corn. I'm pretty sure that's not what fish want to eat.
No, although one of the arguments for the fish in that respect is that if you're going to feed something, fish are one of the most efficient converters, because they don't have to spend any energy defying gravity, and they don't have to keep their blood warm. And so a fish is by far and away the most efficient converter of feedstuffs into flesh, into nutrient-dense food, they're by far the most efficient, more efficient than chicken, more efficient than pig, more efficient than cow. What they can't do is what the herbivore does, where the herbivore has the advantage. You know, you can argue whether or not it's efficient, but the efficiency of the herbivore is that it doesn't require any tillage. And of course, tillage, not only is that very energy and labor intensive, but tillage is also the number one destroyer of soil health, organic matter, and you know, soil degradation. Nature doesn't, you think about it, nature doesn't till. Nature doesn't have a plow. The only plow nature has is, you know, wild pigs and aardvarks and, you know, groundhogs and, you know, prairie dogs and things like, you know, and moles and things that do dig and tillage, but they don't plant behind them. They don't plant annuals. They're burrowing, they're burrowing things, but they don't plant annuals behind them. They simply stimulate the perennials that are already there. So, you know, nature really doesn't have very many annuals. And so here, you know, one of the stories of human civilization is that we have substituted annuals for perennials, and the herbivores that don't need any annuals, we have not mimicked the way they are in nature, and we've overgrazed the perennials, so we've created, you know, desertification and biomass denuding, if you will, of the landscape of the perennials, and then, you know, and then the good areas that the perennials and herbivores built in nature with nice deep soils, those we're now mining and have mined with annuals. And so on both counts, we have assaulted the most historic, the most historic, you know, healing or abundance creating techniques that nature uses.
What would be involved in restoring that sort of overworked, you know, depleted land to natural habitat where you could have things like, you know, pastured cows roaming?
Yeah, well, that's the easy one. And all it takes is water line and electric fence and management. And, of course, that's the whole secret behind the holistic management, Alan Savory, thought models. It's behind Ranching for Profit. It's behind what we do. It was really put forth by a Frenchman named André Voisin in the late 1940s with his it's still the Bible of controlled grazing called grass productivity. And his whole deal was that this grass productivity, that this building of the soil, takes a cycle of disturbance and rest and disturbance and rest, and that's exactly what the undulating, migrating herds of the wildebeest on the Serengeti or the bison on the American plains, that's exactly what they did. And so all we're doing is taking this natural template and saying, how do we duplicate that on a commercial domestic production model? And this could be done. Well, for sake of word pictures and discussion, I've called this mob stocking, herbivorous, solar conversion, lignified carbon sequestration, fertilization. of all of the things that could be done to fundamentally change the food system, the energy footprint, the ecology, and farming economics, by far and away, the most dramatic and easiest one would be to eliminate grain feeding to herbivores and using high-tech electric fencing and water lines to be able to, you know, to disperse a network of water over the landscape. Those two things, that's your infrastructure, and you're up and running. And that conversion could be done in a couple of years. That doesn't take, you know, 30 years of conversion. That could be done very, very quickly.
Wow.
So So I encourage people who really want to eat ancestrally, get rid of the chicken. Forget the chicken and go to the grass-finished herbivore, whether it's lamb, goat, or beef, or, you know, exotics like bison or alpacas or rabbit or whatever. Or guinea pig or groundhog or,
I think chicken is definitely the thing that we eat least in this house. I think also I used to be a vegetarian, and there's still a part of me that thinks, you know, we can take one life and feed for months off of it, or we could take one to two lives and eat one meal off of it. And, you know, whether or not people have that same thought process is up to them, but I try to be respectful in the most amount of ways that I can. And so we personally find that my dad's a hunter. He gets us, one or two, about as free range as it gets deer every year. And then,
yeah, absolutely.
You know,
wonderful.
We do cow and pig, and occasionally we'll throw some chicken in there. But I think for the most part, you know, we've found that that's what works for our family as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. In fact, you know, we may be entering a day when the auto insurance company starts paying a bounty on deer because there's so many of them.
So
many crashes.
And
the problem is the historically normal, you know, normal whatever recreation or you know, adult passage for especially boys, I'll be very sexist, was, you know, to go hunt, and today we're losing them all to arcades and Angry Birds and video games. and so you know, the wildlife guys here in Virginia, I've talked to a couple of game biologists, and they say as far as they can tell, they can literally eliminate hunting season and just open it up for, you know, as much as anybody wants, and would still not harvest what needs to be harvested because it's just not politically correct anymore. It's not chic to go hunting. That's what, you know, barbarians and Neanderthals.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, you know, I grew up a vegetarian and I grew up thinking that what my dad did was barbaric. And as I matured and as I understood more, I realized that what my dad was doing, my parents were divorced, so of course I have my mom's words going in one ear and her beliefs. And so as I matured and I kind of looked at it holistically, I realized that what my dad was doing was actually the most respectful thing for the animals because, yes, especially in this area, they will die by car accident. You know, we can't drive even a couple of miles without seeing, you know, an unfortunate accident by the side of the road just because we're so heavily populated in Northern Virginia. And, you know, it's free range, and he, you know, he's kind of taking care and being respectful of the whole animal, and it's a hobby and sport for him. And interestingly enough, for Father's Day, I actually asked him to take me shooting for the very first time I touched a gun. Like, my dad has the most impressive collection of any person ever, probably. But
And did he, during this exercise, did he talk or did he just grunt?
No. He actually had me go through a 2-hour training session with him before he would even do anything with me. And it was so fascinating to learn the history of everything and how all the different guns were originated. He has some very old historic guns and, you know, different safety mechanisms and all that kind of thing. And I think, you know, it really brought about a different emotion about the whole thing for me. Like, like you explained, this is something that was a rite of passage. This is something that clearly his father had collected these guns and passed it on to him. And they, as a family, ate and had a better life because they were, you know, getting these animals themselves and you know, bringing them home in a way that I think a lot of people today have lost touch with their food and where it's coming from. They think it comes in a styrofoam tray with plastic wrapping and that's where the food comes from. It's like, no, that's not the food. And I challenge everyone to kind of step outside their box and think, you know, what more could I be doing to contribute to the normalcy of the environment? Yeah. What is natural for nature?
Yeah. And what, it's not, yeah. And the other thing that's really critical here is that a true, you know, a true participant in nature participates in nature. You know, we have this idea, you know, Richard Louv, the author, wrote Last Child in the Woods or something, you know, coined the word nature deficit disorder, that you know, we don't go into nature anymore. But
I think
it goes even beyond that, in that we're the first civilization that could actually sit around and debate, I wonder if we should kill animals in order to eat. You know, all of our forefathers were so intimately aware of nature's patterns and where the deer walked on Monday morning and where they went at 8 o'clock in the evening, and that they were so in tune with that and utterly and completely understood their dependency on that knowledge, that there was no time. Just simple survival required participatory ecology. Now, we can debate, you know, that whether they took more than they should have, and there were actually some Native American tribes that had a tremendous environmental ethic, and others that were completely as rapist oriented as, you know, the worst industrialist in the world. So you know, it's fascinating that spanned. I mean, when the Hudson Bay Company came in from Canada and started, you know, sending beaver pelts to England, they actually, you know, went to the tribes and actually had conservation plans. You know, if you'll trap beavers over here for this year and not trap any over there, then you rotate and you alternate your areas. And what Hudson Bay Company found was that about half the Indian tribes totally bought into that and instituted that kind of a rotational harvest thing for sustainable beaver belt populations. And other tribes then would go in and poach on the conservation tribe lands. Well, they're not harvesting this year. We'll go in here and take theirs. And so there was about a 50-50 break, you know, even among Native Americans, as to, you know, the ones that were conservation-minded and looking at it sustainably, and others that were just looking at, you know, how many you know, gold trinkets can I get from these, you know, fur traders this year, and you know, we see the same thing today. But today we have the luxury of being able to sit back in our rocking chairs in our houses and flick a switch and turn on a light and grab the, you know, the TV dinner out of the freezer and, you know, put it in the microwave and have something to eat. And so we can sit around and take all of our extra time that we used to spend expressing our dependency and our visceral understanding of nature being dependent on it. All that time now, we can sit around and act as if we're not dependent on this ecological umbilical, as if we're, you know, haven't we arrived at some cosmic nirvana, you know, sailing off into some Star Trek future with a little green dyed juice for breakfast, and you know, haven't we really gotten beyond this thing called food, you know, and that is called environmentalism by abandonment. And I definitely don't ascribe to environmentalism by abandonment. I ascribe to environmentalism by, you know, by participation.
So, just to, because we've taken up a lot of your time, and I think what would be really interesting for people is on a practical level, kind of a twofold question is, you know, what do you think are some good questions to ask? If we tell people go to a farmer's market and talk to your farmers, or look up on Eat Wild to find a local farmer near you, what are some things that people could look for on one hand, and on another, what do you think are some budget-minded decisions that people can do. Obviously, there are ideas in Eat Like a Dinosaur. I mean, nah, that's our first book, sorry. In Beyond Meat, we tell people, you know, to buy a whole pig and to cook your way through it because it's the most cost-effective way. But for a lot of people, they don't have several hundred dollars to invest up front. Do you have ideas or suggestions being, you know, so acutely aware of...
Sure. Because we have several thousand customers ourselves, and we hear it coming back. So, yeah. Two things as far as you know, who do you buy? How do you vet your source? I'm a big believer on going for a visit. You know, you can say, well, that takes time. Well, you know, so does a Disney vacation and a Caribbean cruise and Netflix. It's just a matter of prioritizing. And so if you took your entertainment budget for next year, you took your entertainment recreation budget for next year and said, you know, for 1 year, we're going to invest that time and money in vetting our food source in a year. And I'm saying a year just because it's a nice block of time, but you'd actually do it a lot faster than that. You could pretty much vet your food source and turn it into a fun activity. I mean, it can become recreational. And if a farmer won't let you come and visit his farm, then mark him off the list. So that's one. I mean, a personal vetting. Number two, of course, is to when you go visit them, is what are you looking for? Well, you don't want to smell any noxious odors. You want to see order. You don't want to see a bunch of chaos and, you know, chickens roosting on the back porch and chicken poop on the, you know, on the dining room table and that sort of thing. And you're looking for a compost pile. You know, ask them where his compost pile is. Ask him, if he doesn't have one, then obviously he's not closing the carbon loop. And just go, you know, look around and ask around a little bit. So, you know, that's my suggestion on that. Now, as far as the economics and the money part of it is, for sure, buying every animal has cheap parts and expensive parts. And so, you know, get the cheap parts. I mean, get pork backbone, beef chuck roast. Obviously a chicken, you know, you want to get a whole chicken. You never want to get, you know, tenders or boneless breasts or whatever. You want to get the whole chicken, and it doesn't take much to learn how to cut up a chicken. You know, you can cut up a chicken pretty easily and quickly. So, get the whole thing, but get the cheaper cuts. And you'll still get all the basic nutrition. In fact, many times those cheaper cuts have more of bony marrow, you know, the really really good stuff by default that you don't get in the real expensive cuts, like, you know, boneless New York strip steak or something like that. So I think our New York strip is whatever it is, like $16 a pound. Our chuck roast is whatever, you know, $4.50 a pound. I mean, that's a huge difference. And so if you shop that way, believe me, you'll save a lot more money than you will trying to buy nutrition out of a can of, you know, of canned ravioli or, you know, Dinners R Us. That processed stuff is extremely expensive. And I know we're talking about meats, but the same thing is true with vegetables. I mean, you don't have to get, microwavable French fries or you know, bagged potato chips. Get full, you know, potatoes and use your technology of a Fry Baby and a Cuisinart and make your own and cook them in lard, you know. And
Sarah did that as soon as she got my book.
Yep.
And you know, you can make lard in your slow cooker, and it's wonderful. And so, you know, then of course that puts me into, you know, get the book Beyond Bacon. You know, it shows you how to take a lot of these inexpensive things. But you're right, a lot of people don't even have a freezer. You know, for many people, their start is, oh, I think we'll buy a freezer. And that's kind of the, you know, one of the entry points to start into this. And once you get that, then it becomes easier to buy bulk. Once you have bulk there, then your meals grow out of what you have rather than growing out whimsically on what you want. And then you become very creative and it all works together.
You just said everything Sarah and I wanted you to say. Thank you. Right down to the bone That's marrow great. In the bones. Yeah. Yeah, we're completely in agreeance with you on all that. I think one of the other things that we've done, and I'm sure you see it often on your farm, is we do meat shares with people. Before, we were buying our whole mm-hmm. animals. And,
oh, sure.
You know, when we had a much smaller deep freeze, mm-hmm. You know, we found groups of local people who would go in on buying whole animals together. And then usually there's a minimum per person. Usually it's not the farm who organizes it, although some farmers will for you. But, you know, if it's a 40 pound minimum, then it's a much less investment than buying half a cow, which is 500 pounds.
And find people to share with. I mean, we routinely... Somebody says, oh my, you know, a half of beef is too much for us. So we'll find somebody to share it with. And then the next thing you know, here's three families show up and here comes the half of beef. And they just take their coolers out and we say, one for me, one for you, one for you, one for me, one for you, one for you. And then, you know, in 10 minutes, that whole thing is spread out. They all chip in 30% and it and they get the complete cost savings. And we get, and actually, you know, it helps us to market. That brings us a new customer that we couldn't have gotten otherwise. And it's a great way to do it, sure. So, I mean, don't expect the farmer to be able to have all your answers. Be proactive here and say, well, if I just find somebody to share this with, we'll be in good shape. Then I won't have to get such a huge volume.
So at the risk of messing up this perfect closure that you've given us here, what are your favorite cuts of meat from the animals that you raise at Polyface, out of curiosity? You mentioned one of my favorites, pork backbone, which not everybody does. It's the way you process your pigs.
Yeah,
so
that's certainly one of my favorites. I would say for me, a good crock pot slow cooked chuck roast. It just doesn't get any better than that. It's moist. It's just fantastic. And you don't have to put anything on it. You know, if it's good quality, it, you know, 40 watts all day, it just sits there and percolates. If you eat at 6 o'clock, it's ready. If you eat at 8 o'clock, it's ready. You know, I mean, talk about the ultimate, you know, no time meal. It's good night. You know, on what is it, on the eighth day, God created crock pots. I mean, good night. I'm borrowing that from the people who say on the eighth day God created soft-sided luggage, but for me it's crock pot. And then on the pork, for sure, it's tenderloin. I'm sorry, tenderloin with applesauce and mashed potatoes and Teresa fries these tenderloins and, you know, a little bit of breading, and it's just to die for. Of course, you know, bacon's hard to beat too. I mean,
but you got to get beyond bacon.
Bacon we do, you know, so often that I guess I don't think. But yeah, the bacon is, and bacon like this that's so dense it doesn't shrink up, it holds its form and it's like
yeah. The first time I had farm bacon, I was like, what was that other stuff I've been eating my whole life?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the way we are with sausage. You know, we had a lady come by the farm last week from 1,000 miles away, and she said, you know, they used to live here and get our stuff, and then they moved away. So I take it fine. She said, we can't find anything like your sausage. We've come. We've got, you know, these coolers. We're gonna fill them up and take them 1,000 miles home because there's nothing like it on the planet. You know.
And wow, that's hardcore. You do have great sausage, but that's hardcore.
That is hardcore, but. Yeah, that's hard to beat too. But yeah, for me, I think it's the pork tenderloin and then the beef chuck roast. I can just eat that just any time, and it has, you know, just the right amount of fat on it. You can eat that fat, and it's just great.
Awesome. Sarah, you have anything else you want to ask?
No, I'm drawing a blank. But can I say, Joel, just what a pleasure it has been to have you on our show tonight, and just thank you so, so much from taking the time out of your desk work. Sorry that we have to send you back to that, but thank you so much for joining us. This has been just really awesome.
Well, good. Well, thank you for having me on, and I trust that it'll be helpful and help to push some folks over the edge into healing the planet one bite at a time.
That's awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to remind everyone and make sure I get this right. Your latest projects are Salad Bar Beef and Fields of Farmers coming out in October.
Yes. Yeah. The coming out. Well, it should be out around the 1st of September, but I'm saying late September just to be on the safe side. But yeah, the title is Fields of Farmers.
Okay.
And the subtitle is Interning, Mentoring, Partnering, and Germinating. It's all about, you know, how to get over this hump of the average age of 60-year-old farmers, and how do we create multi-generational succession plans and get this food produced with a new generation that doesn't have capital, doesn't have equity, and some of the things we talked about tonight, of course, are in the book. The portable farm, low capital, you know, hurdles to, you know, entering and things like that. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I don't know how many people are going to read it, but I think it's, I don't write for sales. I write for what I think the critical prophetic message of the day is. And everywhere I go in the developed world, there's this phenomenon of the 60-year-old farmer, which means, you know, generally most farmers aren't interested in doing something new because at 60, you know, you tend to not do a lot of new things, and so there's not a lot of innovation going on there. And then the second problem is there's this whole host of young people that are ready to join the regenerative economy, you know, and do something on the land, and they don't have capital and they don't have expertise, but they have heart for it. You know, how do they start? How do they get going and you know, work their way into it? Because in many, many cases, the land owners, whether they're farmers or non-farmers, but the people who own the land do not have progeny who wants to participate in that land. I mean, they don't mind owning it. They just don't want to actually go out and do the work. And so so we're having a tremendous amount of abandoned farmland as a result of just, you know, lack of successional partnerships. So that's a new book, and it'll have it's got a lot of classic stories here, and it's pretty bearing of our soul, but that's okay. It describes, I think, where we need to go.
Sounds great.
Yeah, sounds awesome. And one of the things you said is you don't write for sales, you write for what you think the needs are. And I think I'll speak for quite a few people in saying that's what we really admire most about you is, you know, just in the few years that I've been following the real food movement, I've seen, you know, a huge boom in growth. And I, you know, want to personally thank you for your contribution to that movement, because I think you've been a large part of it and the passion that you have and the work that you've done. So,
well, thank you. Thank you. That's great.
And in addition, just a reminder, people can check out the Polyface Primer series, which will be streaming very shortly after this airs. And I would encourage people to do that. I got the privilege of watching one, and it was really interesting and entertaining as well as educational. So, good job. Check those out. And you have a Facebook page as well as your farm's Facebook page, and then now also the Polyface Primer Facebook page. We'll put links to the show notes. Is there anything else that you want people to check out?
Well, that's great. These internet things kind of feed on themselves. So once you get started into one, it's easy to, you know, to link and hop from one to the other. At least other people can figure it out. I'm too old to figure it out. other people can figure it out, and that's great. And it's been a great outreach for us to let us touch a lot of people that we wouldn't have been able to touch in, you know, 30 years ago. So it's kind of cool.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you so much again. And I'm sure my family might see you one time in the future during our annual farm visit. So,
okay.
Thank you and have a wonderful evening with the rest of your paperwork.
I expect I'm going to go to bed now, but anyway, it's been a delight talking with both of you, and thank you for what you're doing for the good of the cause. Blessings on you. Take care.
Thank you. Good night. Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
That was freaking awesome!
We just totally had a podcast with Joel Salatin.
I know!